been a while, but here we go.
Oh, my goodness. Brilliant. All right. First Tuesday back. Give me a break. Hey, everybody. I'm Kyle Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where none of us, maybe me, is as smart as all of us.
Why just you?
I don't know.
Anyway. I'm Kimberly Adams. Thank you so much for joining us. And it's been a while, so I'm happy to be back.
It is so good to have you back. It has been a long while. And let's just say out the gate, this will not be a normal episode. Here's the deal. We had some kludging of schedules today, which is entirely my fault. So we're doing this episode in two tranches. We're going to do me and Kimberly for a little bit. Then Kimberly's going to do the interview by herself, which I'm really, really jealous about because it's a cool topic, which I will let her tell you about. I know. It's so cool. And then I'm going to be back for the second half of the show. So there you go. That's what's going on.
I mean, don't blame yourself too much. It's life.
I tend to do that. I tend to blame myself. All right, here you go. Kimberly, you do it.
All right. So for this weekly deep dive, we are talking about something I am just obsessed over, the James Webb Space Telescope, or hashtag JWST. It is the most powerful space telescope ever. It cost about $10 billion. A ton of tech went into developing this thing. And it's really worth getting smart about because the success of this telescope tells us a lot about NASA and the European Space Agency and the Canadian Space Agency and everything that's going on with these government agencies, plus some things about the way that public versus private funding of space exploration is going right now. So here to make us smart on this topic is Caitlin Casey, a professor of astronomy at the University of Texas at Austin, who is approved to use the telescope and will be leading the largest project on the JWST. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, how excited have you been the last couple of weeks?
Oh my gosh, I cannot contain my excitement. It's been a wild roller coaster getting to this point, and to have this telescope now launched in space, it's just so thrilling for astronomers everywhere, but I hope, you know, more broadly, the public too. I mean, everyone's excited about this telescope, so we can't wait to see its first images.
Which are coming this summer, right?
Yeah. So they're in the process of turning on each camera right now, which will take over 6 months to get everything up and running. And so we hope to get those first images early this summer.
Okay. What is, I mean, other than the fact that it's just cool, what is so special about this telescope? And how does it compare to the Hubble Space Telescope, which is the one that most of us have seen already really amazing images from?
Right. So when we talk about the Webb Telescope, we often hear this comparison, like it's the next Hubble Space Telescope. And it is our closest analogy to the next Hubble Space Telescope, but it is so much more. It is a much larger telescope. It's about 21 feet across as opposed to Hubble, which is only 8 feet across. And the size means that we're able to see objects that are about 100 times fainter than Hubble can see. And keep in mind that Hubble has seen the faintest things ever recorded by human civilization so far. So it will go that much deeper. And also, because it's a larger telescope, it gives us sharper resolution. So even the exquisite detail we see on, you know, nebulae and distant galaxies in the universe with Hubble, we will see that improve with James Webb Space Telescope.
So what are you and your team working on in particular once you can sort of tap into what the telescope is seeing?
My team is working on discovering some of the most distant galaxies that have ever been found. And we will find many, many more than Hubble has found because JWST is able to see objects so much deeper. So we're building what's called a deep field, which is similar to Hubble Deep Field. If listeners have ever seen that image, it's an image that represents
Let's just assume that we haven't.
Okay. Yeah. So the Hubble Deep Field is the deepest image ever taken of space. So I really encourage everyone to go look it up online if you haven't seen it. It is a very small patch of sky that would otherwise appear totally blank or dark to the naked eye. It's a patch of sky that's roughly the size of a head of a pin if you're holding that pin at arm's length away from you. So a very tiny patch of sky. And in that patch of sky, Hubble found thousands of sources of light that are the faintest sources of light we've ever seen. We now know them to be galaxies, which are collections of billions of stars stretched out across enormous distances in the cosmos. And they are so far away that the light traveling from these distant galaxies has taken most of the history of our universe to reach us, to reach the Hubble Space Telescope. So what we're doing with JWST is we're building bigger, better deep fields that will see farther into the past. They will see more exquisite detail and will be able to understand how the universe itself assembled in just a couple hundred million years after the Big Bang, which represents an era of cosmic dawn when everything is forming for the first time. And so we'll be able to see that directly with JWST.
Will we be able to see aliens?
That's a great question. Sadly, no. We will not be able to see aliens with JWST. But the search continues. The search continues. And it sounds almost, silly, I'm sure, to some that there are legitimate efforts to search for intelligent life out there. But it is getting to be more and more of a serious search with every passing year. So what we will learn from JWST for understanding aliens is we will take this step of actually being able to see what's in the atmospheres of Earth-like planets around other stars. So not around our sun, not in our solar system. We will see actual atmospheric composition. Like, is there oxygen? Is there water vapor? What's in the atmospheres of planets orbiting other stars? Would those planetary systems be habitable to life? We will get answers to that with JWST.
Can you give a sense of the scale when it comes to the time, the money, the resources, the emotional strain that went into building this telescope?
Oh, boy. Yeah. So this telescope represents such a monumental effort, not just for astronomers who love to look at the night sky, but for engineers, for the government, for all of the different players involved. So JWST, you might be aware, has this price tag of $10 billion, which sounds like so much, but it actually is just a drop in the bucket compared to the overall budget for NASA. And also, it should be pointed out, it's a very large international collaboration. So it is a partnership of NASA and the European Space Agency and also the Canadian Space Agency that have pooled resources together to make this telescope happen. It has been in progress for over 20 years. Right when Hubble first got its first images, like the Hubble Deep Field, that was when we started planning for James Webb. I wasn't planning because I was 10 years old, but I have become aware that, the telescope process started really early on. And so it has had some stumbling blocks along the way. It's had some delays because the technology is brand new. and invented for the purpose of making this telescope work. We haven't had a telescope like JWST before. We can't just, you know, go to the Telescopes R Us store and say, yes, I'll have that one for $10 billion. Thanks. You know, we are inventing this thing as we've gone along in the process. And so the cost represents the effort of all of the personnel involved, both representing personnel from funded by the government through federal grants, but also through private industry. So there are companies like Northrop Grumman, Ball Aerospace have been really involved in the development of this facility. And then, of course, its launch into space, which was so successful on Christmas Day, December 25th of last year, was made possible by Arianespace, which is a French aerospace company that launches packages and payloads on behalf of the European Space Agency. So it really represents the culminating effort of thousands of people around the globe to make a mission like this happen.
Where does this mission sit in sort of the balance of what NASA is doing compared to what private industry is doing in space right now?
For sure. Space is a happening place right now. I'm sure folks can appreciate that there's been a lot of discussion of crewed spaceflight missions, human spaceflight, over the past year or so, with companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic having some of their first, you know, launches into having crewed spaceflight. And NASA, of course, has been the big player in all of this for decades, right? In the 1960s with the Apollo program, that invented the field of spaceflight in the U.S. And so it has been a major part of NASA's portfolio. It represents roughly half of NASA's budget dedicated to human spaceflight. But programs like this telescope, JWST, are not a part of that at all, right? It is completely robotic. It is part of NASA's science portfolio, which is roughly only a third of its entire budget. So I think in the future, we're going to see a continued diverse portfolio for NASA in terms of the what it covers in terms of human spaceflight. But the theme going forward certainly is lots of private-public partnerships where SpaceX is involved in sending humans to the ISS, you know. So we're going to see more of that for sure.
For as long as the ISS lasts.
Right, right. Yeah. So, I mean, but in terms of, you know, my perspective as an astronomer and, you know, a user of telescopes, that human spaceflight arm of NASA, it operates totally independently. The budget for telescopes for understanding our own universe, that is really, you know, segregated off in a different corner of NASA's budget. And, you know, the two rarely mix.
You know, it feels like NASA is still involved in human spaceflight, but the commercial sector is not so much. You have NASA with the James Webb Space Telescope and looking out into the galaxies, but the commercial sector is really focused on commercial satellites and space tourism and those sorts of things. Even with these public-private partnerships, do you see the commercial space industry as moving into the hard sciences at any point?
That's a great question. I think you're right that it has been really quiet in terms of discussions of private investment in space astrophysics, you know, the hard science. But there is some crossover, and some of it is actually not all good. So you are probably aware that There are these groups of satellites being launched into space called constellation satellites that will do great things, mm-hmm. like, for example, bringing high-speed internet to every corner of the globe. But they also have...
This is Starlink.
Yeah, this is the Starlink project, yeah. But there are other constellation satellites mm-hmm. as well, you know, other than Starlink. But Starlink has this mm-hmm. Noble goal of bringing high-speed internet to every corner of the globe. But there are also some drawbacks that haven't really been discussed in an organized way. It's not regulated by the government very much. For example, constellation satellites will have significant negative impact on the operation of telescopes on the ground. They basically look like mm-hmm. little streaks across the sky. You can see them actually at nighttime pass overhead, and they make it very difficult to operate telescopes that are not in space but that are on the ground, which represent kind of a big fraction of how we learn about the universe. And there's also some concern that constellation satellites will increase space debris and create a non-negligible hazard to spacecraft that want to go up and, you know, pass through this minefield of material and satellites that have been launched into space. And so there is, you know, some discussion that potentially that's harmful to, you know, the broader, you know, not just what when we look up in the night sky, will we even see stars anymore, but also the concern of whether or not we will be able to avoid space debris in future launches. So that's one.
But isn't that happening now?
Yeah, it's happening now, and it's largely happening in a way that's not highly regulated. You know, kind of space is our new Wild West. And so, you know, there aren't a lot of regulations on who can launch what. And so, yes, it's happening. And I think we might be in a point a couple years from now where we should probably evaluate if everything that has been launched was a good idea. I mean, there are some mitigation strategies that companies like SpaceX are, you know, they certainly hear the concerns of the community and they're trying to address them. It is not entirely clear that given the vast number of satellite launched into space that we will have, you know, this under our control in 5 to 10 years' time. But it would be great, though, on the flip side, to also see private companies show interest in supporting telescope development going forward in the future. It should be pointed out that Hubble Space Telescope and developing the technology for James Webb Space Telescope, that has led to significant technological development and spin-offs that significantly enhance other industries like medical equipment, eye surgery, use of lasers, optics, precision wow. sensors that are used in airplanes, GPS. A lot of these industries have come about because of the technological developments made by telescopes. And, you know, just trying to get the best telescopes off the ground. And so I do see significant room for huge technological strides if we're able to form more partnerships and get more projects off the ground.
Okay, I could talk about this for ages, but I'm going to let you go. That is Caitlin Casey, professor of astronomy at the University of Texas at Austin, who is going to be using the James Webb Space Telescope once it's fully up and running. So happy stargazing.
Thank you so much. Can't wait to see those images.
So tell us what you think. Our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-82-SMART, or leave us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org with what you're excited about seeing from the James Webb Space Telescope. And we will be right back with Kai.
No, that's not the sting. Other sting. Is that the... Is that
that was a sting.
Is that the right sting?
It has been a while.
Oh, my God. Somebody ought to fire me. Oh, my lordy be.
No, we'll public radio can't there. Lose just any to, more people, look. Kai.
Kimberly, don't say that out loud. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so let us just proceed, shall we? Because obviously yes. I'm back on the pod now. Miracle of podcasting.
Yes, oh, it's magic. It is the magic of, not radio, yes, podcasting, but audio. Oh, magic.
Yes.
And it's time for the news fix. So, Kai, since right. everybody's been hearing my voice, let's start with yours.
Oh, my goodness. All right. So mine is prompted by two things. One is reality, and the other one is a note that we got from our corporate overlords in St. Paul at the American Public Media Group saying, to nobody's surprise, oh, look, we're pushing back the date for our voluntary return to office. And I think we need to get this out on the table that this, you know, we've been, well, that's not true. Not all of us, but some people have been eager to get back to the office. There's a certain camaraderie, blah, blah, blah. Yes, schedules can be more flexible now, and we've all learned things in the pandemic. But, you know, a lot of people have been looking forward to getting back to the office in some way, shape, or form. And I think we just need to acknowledge that that is not going to happen for a good long while, because not only is Omicron here, but whatever the next variant is going to be here, and we're going to be muddling through. And I think everybody just needs to get ready for it not to be happening. And my you know, news peg, if you will, if we need this, other than what APMG says, is this piece in the journal today saying other companies, lots of other companies are saying, you know what, we're not going to predict this anymore. We're just going to say you get back to the office when you get back to the office, but it ain't going to be now. And that includes Marketplace. So that's that. Number two, and more substantively, electric cars. They are really, really hard to build. Well, no, I'll tell you how I got here. What? Okay, what?
Okay.
What? You want to know how I made that turn?
I would say that the pandemic is also very substantive, just, you know.
Well, no, that's true. You're right. You know what? That's a really good point, because I think a lot of us have now internalized it so much, and it has faded to, in some degree, to background noise. Like, you're like, okay, yeah, of course we're all going to go late back to the office or whatever. I don't even know. Okay, so electric cars. We really want to get one in this house. We want to get a couple of them because we got a couple of drivers. And we've got our eyes open. My wife has decided she really likes the Rivians. I really hate the way they look, but she gets to decide how we spend our money, so we might get one. I don't know.
Right.
But here's the point. Electric cars, for all the glory that Tesla gets and for all the press that Elon Musk gets and for as fun as Teslas are to drive, and yes, there's a bunch of other less expensive models, they are really hard to build. Cars are really, really, really hard to build and sell, right? I mean, the big car companies sell like 8 million cars a year, and Tesla sells a minuscule fraction of that. And now there's another company called Rivian, which just yesterday announced, oh, my goodness, we're not going to make our production targets, and an executive is leaving. They do say the executive is leaving because of a long-scheduled retirement. But the production problems are the real thing. And if you remember, Tesla had them too, and still does to some degree have them. And I just think before we all start banking on, you know, everybody having electric cars, we need to acknowledge that the internal combustion engine side of that business had a 90, maybe 110-year head start. And it ain't going to be all that soon that we're all going to have electric cars, even though we might want them. And that's that. That's my spiel.
No, Kai. No? We talked over on Marketplace Tech to one of the editors from CNET who'd been covering CES, the Consumer Electronics Show this year, which has basically become an auto show. And everybody and their mother has an electric vehicle. And he was saying that people are going to look back at 2022 as the year that electric cars really went mainstream, and they're looking at this Chevy Silverado electric pickup
truck. The trucks,
and the trucks,
for sure.
And even Sony has an electric car, and he's actually predicting kind of the opposite. Like, yes, it's hard to make, but everyone is getting into it, that the speed of adoption and advancement is about to really ramp up. So, I mean,
I totally hope he's right. Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on the startup side of things, I definitely can see, like, that's going to be, it's really hard to go from zero to electric car in like a couple of years.
Sure,
but these sort of established. That's funny. I didn't realize I did that. Yeah. Thanks. It was an accident. But, you know, the.
Yeah.
Okay.
Look, well,
but these companies with established assembly lines, I think they may have a little bit easier of a time of it. That's all. I think that's a fair point.
That's a fair point. No, but I mean, you know, you're an observer and a consumer of news.
I'm an observer. I ride in cars. And there's the ship horn.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good. Little verisimilitude. You know, I mean, I'm in my shed this morning, so, you know, there could be dogs barking any time. So let's get on.
Yeah, I removed the bell from my cat before we started because, without fail, this is the moment when he would decide to actively play. Okay. Yeah. So I'll go on to my news fix, which is less fun but so important.
No, but it's amazing. It's amazing.
Washington Post has this amazing in-depth investigation. I think it took the reporter more than a year to do this, but it's detailed, it's long, and they had a look of all the people who ever served in the U.S. Congress who owned human beings, that actually enslaved people. And there were more than 1,700 people who served in the U.S. Congress, I'm reading straight from the piece, in the 18th, 19th, and even 20th centuries, who at one point or another owned people. And what's super fascinating about this is it digs into how that impacted policy. Because, you know, even today we talk about how much where a member of Congress comes from and their upbringing, how it affects how they, you know, pursue policy, how they investigate things, and the type of legislation that they support. And so if you think about that many people who ran our country that owned other people, of course it would shape policy. And this is particularly fascinating coming at this time when there's such a national debate over how we learn our own history and how we teach our own history, and schools all over the country, you know, in battles with state legislatures or school boards or even parents about what they can and cannot say about the history of our country. And, you know, it's important that we know. I learned so much from this investigation. I really did. It's really good.
Yeah.
Can't recommend it enough.
It's amazing. It's ongoing. In fact, I think they have asked for public help, and, you know, they found the 1,700, but there are certainly more that are not yet documented, and they asked for public help finding this. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, who else is on this list. It's craziness that it hadn't been actually examined before, you know? It's kind of wild.
And these weren't just Southern members of Congress from the air quotes slaveholding states.
Right.
You know,
right.
These people were from all over. I mean, I'm not going to do it justice, so I just, you know, it's going to be on the show page. It's really, really good.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Check it out.
Okay. Right. Yeah, I guess we should move on to the mailbag.
Let's go. Let us do that.
Hi, Make Me Smart team.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Okay. On Twitter, at MJ Graves from Houston, tweeted us about Lake Superior University's list of banished words from 2022, and included in the list is deep dive, which is obviously, as per today, a very well-used term here on Tuesdays. And I should acknowledge here, much to the chagrin of the folks on Discord who have pointed out to me on numerous occasions that they feel we do not go deep enough into our deep dives. And so they are asking that we stop use that term. Stop using that term.
Sure.
I should also say that on the list is supply chain, which I don't really know how in our field we're going to...
What are we going to do? What?
I think I looked at the website, and what they're talking about is how everyone blames every single shortage and every single problem in the economy right now on supply chain. Yeah. So I get that, but we're talking about the supply chain.
Yeah.
Also, new normal, 100% agree that needs to go because you're on mute.
How are you supposed to tell people? You got to tell people.
The argument is
hold up the big L in front of your forehead and go, loser. Loser. Well, I mean, you got to.
I dare you in the next meeting. I will laugh so hard.
Only if it's one with our corporate overlords. How about that? All right.
Stop it, Kai.
Too many people leaving public radio already. Anyway.
And at the top of the list is one of your favorites.
I know.
Which I see you put on Twitter all the time. Wait, what?
Are
you
going to
drop it?
You're like, wait, what? No, I'm not going to drop it. I have the courage of my convictions, Ms. Adams. The courage of my convictions. All right.
Yes. You do you, Kai Rizdahl.
I will do me. All y'all could do all y'all. I mean, you know, tell us what you like, don't like about words that we use on this podcast. We'll consider adding them to our banish list or not. I don't know. Make me smart at marketplace.org. You know how to get a hold of us. Okay. So before we went away for the holidays, we asked you about your travel plans. If you had anywhere you wanted to go, here is one of the replies we got.
Hey, Make Me Smart friends. This is Ryan from Rochester, New York. Home of Eastman Kodak, home of Xerox, and home of the culinary masterpiece known as the garbage plate. Look that up sometime.
I
wanted to say my wife and I just a few weeks ago booked a trip to Portugal. However, about 10 days after we booked that trip, which is going to be like the end of March, we all had to start learning how to pronounce Omicron. Turns out that Portugal is actually maybe the most vaccinated country in the world. Something like 90% or close to it of people are vaccinated there. So we're like cautiously optimistic, but still a little nervous that we're going to have a second vacation that has been canceled by this pandemic. Anyway, thanks for making
me
smart.
Fair.
Oh, I hope not.
Fair.
Good luck.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish everyone's vacations to go well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you going anywhere?
No, hanging around. What can I tell
you? My family has yet another cruise planned, Kai.
No way! Kimberly, tell your mother to stop doing that.
This one wasn't my mother. this one is my sister.
Oh my God. What is it with your family? Let's go. Are you kidding me? I honestly can't even believe it. I kind of can't even believe it.
Okay. Anyway, we're going to leave you with today's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew, you later found out you were wrong about? This week's answer comes from Adam Rees. He's a professor of astronomy at Johns Hopkins University and one of the winners of the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics. And I interviewed him recently on Marketplace Tech about, you know, of course, the James Webb Space Telescope, because I'm a nerd and I love it.
Yes.
Well, to be honest with you, the first thing that jumps into my mind is that the ability to make progress in many fields, I used to think, just depended on how smart you were. And what I learned over time is more often how maybe determined you are, how much sort of grit that you have, that, you know, it's not all inspiration. A lot of it is the perspiration.
Amen.
Yeah, I totally buy that. You got to put in the work. You got to do the work.
Yes, it's about drive. It's about power. Anyway, don't forget to send us your answer.
What are you really trying to tell us, Kimberly?
No, I mean, I've been spending too much time watching TikToks and Instagram Reels lately, but that's a whole other thing. Okay. Don't forget to send us your answer to the Make Me Smart question. You can consider calling us and leaving us a voice message on our number, 508-82-SMART. We really appreciate it. And Make Me Smart will be back tomorrow.
We will
God
be.
Willing, and the creek don't rise.
There you go. I love that thing. Reasons I don't even know. Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Our team also includes producer Mark A. Green, Tony Wagner, writing our newsletters, Also, welcome to our newer intern, Tiffany Bowie. Yay, new interns.
Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe and Drew Jostad, with mixing by Emma Erdbrink. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner. Donna Tam is the director of On Demand. And Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough.
Excellent. Excellent.
We did the Amalgamation Podcast for the win.
Yes. Yes.